The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm so delighted to see many friends and colleagues here. I lived in Philadelphia for about 7 years, and it's wonderful to come back here. And it's also wonderful to be in one of my favorite libraries in the world and one of my favorite urban buildings, too. So thank you for having me, and many thanks to Andy. Well, the Swan Thieves is not about vampires. It is mostly about painters, and particularly the French Impressionists and some contemporary painters whom I made up, but who live in real places in the late 20th century in the United States. And I wanted to read a little bit of, wanted to read you one chapter that comes from a part of the book set in the 19th century, and then I'll back up or go the wrong direction and read you the prologue, which is very short. And I should say just very briefly what the story is about for those of you who don't have it right in front of you. It's the story of Robert Oliver, who is a painter who is arrested for attempting to stab a painting in the 19th century gallery of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. And his case comes to the attention of the narrator of the book, Andrew Marlowe, who is a psychiatrist in Washington, D.C., and also an avid amateur painter. And the two of them collide in ways that really shake up Andrew Marlowe's world and send him on a journey to find out who this man could be. Robert Oliver refuses to speak in Andrew Marlowe's care, so Marlowe is forced to do a lot of research into this man's life. And some of that research leads him by a winding road into a mystery that is part of French Impressionism. So the book moves back and forth between the late 20th century in the United States and Paris and Normandy and other places in France in the 1870s and 80s. And I'd like to read you chapter 77, which starts on page 436, and it's set in 1879. The characters in this chapter are Beatrice, who is the female figure in this chapter, and she is a painter, a young married painter, who is gradually finding herself drawn to her husband's uncle, who is also a painter, much older than she is, of course, and seems to be the only person in her world who really understands her and what she does. And they're on the beach in Normandy. 1879. She watches Olivier paint. They are standing on the beach in the afternoon light, and he has begun a second canvas, one for morning, one for afternoon. He is painting the cliffs and two large gray rowboats the fishermen have pulled far up on shore, their oars stowed inside, the nets and cork floats catching an elusive sun. He sketches first with burnt umber on the primed canvas, and then begins to mass in the cliffs with more umber, with blue, a shadowy gray-green. She wants to suggest that he lighten his palette, as her teacher once told her. She wonders why this scene of shifting lights and sky looks to Olivier so somber underneath. But she believes that neither his work nor his life can change much now. She stands in silence beside him, about to set up her own work, her folding stool and portable wooden easel, delaying, observing. She wears a thin wool dress against the chill of the afternoon's brightness, and over that a heavier wool jacket. The breeze catches at her skirt, the ribbons of her bonnet. She watches him bring the churning water partly to life. But why doesn't he put more light into it? She turns away and buttons her smock over her clothes, arranges her canvas, unfolding the clever wooden stool. She stands before the easel as he does, instead of sitting, digging her boot heels in among the pebbles. She tries to forget his figure not far away, his silver head bowed over the work, his back upright. Her own canvas is already washed a pale gray. She has chosen this one for afternoon light. She puts in aquamarine, a heavy smudge on her palette, cadmium red for the poppies on the cliffs to the far left and right, her favorite flowers. Now she gives herself 30 minutes by the watch on her chain, squints, holds the brush as lightly as she can, painting with wrist and forearm, quick strokes. The water is rose-colored, blue-green, the sky nearly colorless, the stones of the beach are rosy and gray, the foam at the edge of the waves is beige. She paints in Olivier's dark-suited form, his white hair, but as if he stands at a great distance, a minor figure on the strand. She touches the cliffs with raw umber, then green, then with the red specks of poppies. There are white flowers as well and smaller yellow ones. She can see the cliff, both up close and far off. Her 30 minutes are gone. Olivier turns as if he understands that her first pass over the canvas is finished. She sees that he is still working slowly across an expanse of water, has not yet reached the boats again or even the cliffs. It will be a careful piece, controlled and even beautiful, and it will take days. He steps near to see her canvas. She stands staring at it with him, feeling his elbow brush her shoulder. She is conscious of her skill, as seen through his eyes, and of the painting's flaws. It is alive, moving, but too rough for even her taste. An experiment that fails. She wants him to be silent, and to her relief, he doesn't interrupt the rumble of the waves and the heavy gravel, the wash of stones rolled over and out to sea. Instead, he nods, looks down at her. His eyes are permanently reddened, a little loose around the edges. At that moment, she would not trade his presence for anything in the world, simply because he is so much closer to the edge of it than she is. He understands her. That evening, they eat with the other guests, sitting across from each other, passing the dishes of sauce or little mushrooms. The landlady serving veal to Olivier says that a gentleman has come by that afternoon to ask if she had a famous painter there, a friend of his from Paris. He left no card. Is Monsieur Vigneault famous? She asks. Olivier laughs and shakes his head. Plenty of famous painters have worked in Etretat, but he is hardly one of them, he says. Beatrice drinks a glass of wine and regrets it. They sit in the main parlor reading with a mustached English guest who rustles the paper from London and clears his throat over something he sees there. Then she puts her book down and tries to write a second letter to Eve without much success. Her pen seems not to like the paper, no matter how many times she dips and blots. The landlady's Mandarin clock strikes 10, and Olivier rises to bow to her, smiles affectionately out of his wind-reddened eyes, seems about to kiss her hand, but then does not. When he has gone upstairs, she understands. He will never invite more from her. He will never visit her in private, will never propose that she visit him, will never make another move that a gentleman and relative should not. He will initiate nothing. The kiss in his studio was his first and last, as he promised. Her kiss on the station platform was her own responsibility, as was their kiss on the beach. Both took him by surprise. He means this restraint as a gift, she is certain, a proof of his respect, his care. But the result is a cruel dilemma. Whatever happened, she must affect herself and live with later. Whatever they experience together will spring from her own desire, her comparative youth. She cannot imagine knocking on his door upstairs. He has left her a trail of breadcrumbs, like the boy in the fairy tale. Later, she hardly sleeps in her white bed, watching the curtains move a little where she has left a window open to the menace of the night air, feeling the town around her, hearing the channel maul the shale on the strand. And then I'd like just to read you the prologue. So this is the very first thing you come to in the book. Outside the village, there is a fire ring, blackening the thawing snow. Next to the fire ring is a basket that has sat there for months and is beginning to weather to the color of ash. There are benches where the old men huddle to warm their hands. Too cold even for that now. Too close to twilight. Too dreary. This is not Paris. The air smells of smoke and night sky. There is a hopeless amber sinking beyond the woods, almost to sunset. The dark is coming down so quickly that someone has already lit a lantern in the window of the house nearest the deserted fire. It is January or February, or perhaps a grim March, 1895. The year will be marked in rough black numbers against the shadows in one corner. The roofs of the village are slate, stained with melting snow, which slides off them in heaps. Some of the lanes are walled, others open to the fields and muddy gardens. The doors to the houses are closed, the scent of cooking rising above the chimneys. Only one person is astir in all this desolation, a woman in heavy traveling clothes walking down a lane toward the last huddle of dwellings. Someone is lighting a lantern there, too, bending over the flame, a human form, but indistinct in the distant window. The woman in the lane carries herself with dignity, and she isn't wearing the shabby apron and wooden sabots of the village. Her cloak and long skirts stand out against the violet snow. Her hood is edged with fur that hides all but the white curve of her cheek. The hem of her dress has a geometric border of pale blue. She is walking away with a bundle in her arms, something wrapped tightly as if against the cold. The trees hold their branches numbly toward the sky. They frame the road. Someone has left a red cloth on the bench in front of the house at the end of the lane, a shawl perhaps, or a small tablecloth, the only spot of bright color. The woman shields her bundle with her arms, with her gloved hands, turning her back on the center of the village as quickly as possible. Her boots click on a patch of ice in the road. Her breath shows pale against the gathering dark. She draws herself together, close, protective, hurrying. Is she leaving the village or hastening toward one of the houses in the last row? Even the one person watching doesn't know the answer, nor does he care. He has worked most of the afternoon, stroking in the walls of the lanes, positioning the stark trees, measuring the road, waiting for the 10 minutes of winter sunset. The woman is an intruder, but he puts her in, too, quickly, noting the details of her clothes, using the failing daylight to brush in the silhouette of her hood, the way she bends forward to stay warm or to hide her bundle. A beautiful surprise, whoever she is. She is the missing note, the movement he needed to fill that central stretch of road with its dirt-pocked snow. He has long since retreated, working now just inside his window. He is old, and his limbs ache if he paints out of doors in the cold for more than a quarter of an hour. So he can only imagine her quick breath, her step on the road, the crunch of snow under her sharp boot heel. He is aging, ill, but for a moment he wishes she would turn and look straight at him. He pictures her hair as dark and soft, her lips vermilion, her eyes large and wary. But she does not turn, and he finds he is glad. He needs her as she is, needs her moving away from him into the snowy tunnel of his canvas, needs the straight form of her back and heavy skirts with their elegant border, her arm cradling the wrapped object. She is a real woman, and she is in a hurry, but now she is also fixed forever. Now she is frozen in her haste. She is a real woman, and now she is a painting. Thank you very much. So I understand we have some time for questions, and I'll do my best to provide answers if anyone would like to ask one, or two or three. And we have microphones as well, so if when you ask a question, if you can wait for someone to come all the way up with the microphone, that would be great for their podcast. Yes.
Could you say a little bit about how you came to this topic for the book?
Well, I had wanted for a long time to try to write a book about a painter. I love paintings, and I've always been interested in art history. And I started thinking about the idea of a painter who wouldn't get to speak for himself, but whose life would kind of rise up three-dimensionally out of other people's voices. And then I began to invent this character, Robert Oliver. And then I realized that he would be obsessed with something and that it would probably be painting from the past. And I chose the French Impressionists because I was already interested in them. So it really, there was no kind of dramatic Dracula moment with this book, but just a gradual piecing together of things that I found really interesting. Yes, in the front here.
Could you tell us about Bulgarian folk singing, if you're involved?
Would you like me to sing something? I don't usually do this in public. I don't have my singing partners. Zvonče drunka v česta gora, ajdele ne zvonče. Ne zvonče, kato zvonče. It's a very good microphone. So, gosh, that was tolerant of you. I got interested in Balkan folk singing when I was in college. And the college I went to had a Balkan women's choir or Slavic women's choir, and we sang a lot of music from Bulgaria. So I ended up going there with several friends on a fellowship to do research. And mainly we were interested in the question of whether these village songs were still being passed down and by whom. And we made a lot of tapes, audio tapes in those days that are now in the Library of Congress Folklife Center. So, and now I don't sing anymore except for you and maybe in the shower because my children can't stand it. So, so I hope that answered your question. Somebody else? Yes.
What's your background?
What's my background? You mean my ethnic background? Or, I come from a Norwegian and Scotch-Irish family from North Carolina and other places, and I studied mostly English literature in college and a lot of art history as well. And after that, I mowed lawns for a long time. And then I guess that's what you do with an English literature degree. If you don't become a professor. And I come from a family of professors and librarians and people who love writing and literature and history. And eventually I went back to school and got an MFA in the writing of fiction, which helped me a lot to finish the historian. Yes.
When you had your Dracula moment, what part of the Appalachians were you hiking in?
The part called Transylvania. I was hiking in South Carolina, right on the North Carolina border. And I think actually it probably wasn't an accident that I thought of Dracula then, because I associate Dracula with the mountains of the Balkans and, of course, the Carpathians. And there was something about coming out on above this incredible view that reminded me of being in Eastern Europe. So, Yes.
One of the most interesting things about your writing is the sense of place and geography. Do you make a habit of traveling to where you're writing about, or do you do it more on a research basis?
Well, you know, it was very different with my two books. With The Historian, I was writing about places I had been in the past, previously, and I had to do a lot of research to kind of corroborate my own memories and journals. And then with The Swan Thieves, I had more time and ability to go somewhere else. And I didn't do very much travel for it, but I did go to Paris and what a drag to have to do research in France. And I went to the coast of Normandy, which I had never seen before and which is amazing. And it's part of the Channel Coast, and it's really very much like it was when Monet was painting there, with the exception of one thing, which is that now it's rather quiet. And in Monet's day, it was absolutely jammed with people. It was one of the first places Parisians could go on vacation on the new train lines. So everybody went there. It was a kind of quick, easy, relatively cheap vacation from Paris in the 1860s, 70s, 80s. And became very fashionable eventually. So when you see those incredible empty scenes of beach and sky and cliffs that the Impressionists painted in places like that, they really were souvenirs of a place you couldn't see without 20,000 other people. So it was something you could take home and hang in your Paris drawing room and remember what it could have been like without the crowds. But it was amazing to go and see that in person, because there are a lot of sights and sounds that I wouldn't have known to include in The Swan Thieves if I hadn't gone there. Yes.
Hi. Since we're talking about geography, I wanted to ask you about your Chestnut Hill connection, because I thought you were talking about my first girlfriend at Springside, but I'll let you answer that.
So I didn't quite understand the question. I'm sorry. We were talking about Chestnut.
You have a reference to Chestnut Hill in Philadelphia, in Swan Thieves, I believe. Mary is from Chestnut Hill, correct? And she works at the hospital.
Ah, yes, that's right. I was trying to place that. I'm sorry, that's very true. There are several Philadelphia references in this book. In fact, one of the characters is from Philadelphia, and she is the one who works at Springside. The other one is not from Philadelphia, but she has grandparents and great-grandparents who lived here. And they have very separate lives, but one of them notes this and says, perhaps we were even related in Philadelphia way back. And one of the narrators of the book also goes to Germantown Friend School. I mean, you know, disguised a little bit, but I think it's pretty obvious what it is and where it is, where some of my children went to nursery school. So it was really, I found it really wonderful fun to write about American places this time. And I hadn't done that before, weirdly. And it was challenging in the sense that when material is much closer to you, you know, when you've been to Chestnut Hill hundreds of times, you suddenly realize how, two things, I think. One, how little we all really observe, even if we think we're observant, and how much you have to go back and really look at things and think about them. And also how much more difficult it is sometimes to write about material that's very close to you and make it vivid, because you have a lot of assumptions that other people can sort of see it. And so that was fun and challenging. And yes, I'm very proud to have that in the book. Another question? Yes, down here.
Are you surprised by the vampire craze that's currently gripping our country with True Blood and the Stephanie Meyer Twilight series?
I'm not very surprised by it, just because I did a lot of reading about vampire, the history of vampire literature when I was writing The Historian. And I actually don't read vampire genre literature myself. I've never been very interested in that. And I'm always very sympathetic when someone says to me, well, I picked up The Historian and I never would have thought I could like a vampire book. And I'd never read one before, and someone gave it to me, and I said, I don't read vampire books. I'm completely sympathetic to that attitude, because in many ways I have it myself. But I think that it's important to remember that there have been vampire crazes off and on since about 1790. And this one will fade, and then we'll have another one in 2031. And everyone will say, oh, I remember in my youth there was... In my extreme youth, there was some kind of vampire craze. What was that about? It's sort of the nature of vampires that they never die. And they will always be with us, whether we like it or not. So I think that also, on a sort of deeper level of analysis, and again, this is just a theory, and some people share it and some people don't. I think that vampires are very kind of satisfying, safe place to put fear. And in times of social unease, we tend to have these kind of monsters who are thought-provoking, but also a sort of channel for our thoughts about good and evil, our sense of security or insecurity. And that was true when Frankenstein was written. That was socially true, and I think that may be part of what has prompted this craze for safe and attractive villains. Although I have to say, most of the vampires who are running around now are kind of younger and more handsome than my characters, who tend to be actual human beings and librarians, other things, not 17-year-old bodybuilders. So, do we have time for one more? Oh, yes, for several more in the back.
I was anxiously awaiting the second book. So because of the time span between the first and second novel, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your writing process. Did it take that long to write, or was it that long waiting for the idea, or is it because you're a parent?
All of the above, I think. Yes, it took that long to write. And actually, it took me 10 years to write The Historian, but I was extremely busy during that time. Sort of insanely busy. And teaching a lot on top of everything else. And it took me 4 years to write The Swan Thieves. And that seemed to me so fast that it left skid marks on my desk. It was just, to write a book in 4 years after you've written one in 10 is just feels kind of breathless. And at the same time, I think a lot of my slowness as a writer has to do with research, because I do a lot of research. I do it thoroughly. I enjoy it. I'm distracted by it. And so that's a process I give its weight. This time it was a little easier because I had a deadline. So that helps all of us in some way. And I found that I was able to write with more kind of intensity because of that. And that was a great experience, actually. So, yes. Yes, in the back there.
Hi. I want to ask a question about The Historian, actually. Back when The Historian came out, pretty much every reviewer made comparisons to the Da Vinci Code and the Dan Brown formula, if you will. I was wondering, did that ever get to you? Like, were you flattered by it? Did you hate it? Were you indifferent to it? I was just curious, because it was like pretty much every review said that, and I was just curious what your take was, if you even knew that.
Well, I'm not sure every review said that. I think some did, and many interviewers asked me that as well. And it always surprised me, because to me the two books seem very different. They have in common, I suppose, a kind of chase for documents or historical information and dark secrets from the past that are encoded somehow that historians have access to. But I think the comparison really kind of ends there. I was unaware of the Da Vinci Code pretty much while I was writing The Historian, because I started it about 9 years before The Da Vinci Code was published. And I think it really, in many ways, appeals to a different kind of reader. It's very much formula commercial fiction, and it has some wonderful mechanisms of suspense, but it's you have a very strong sense, I think, all through of where it's going. And I think the Da Vinci Code did a great thing for a lot of literary novelists, and that was to make a wider readership available for history novels, for kind of more serious history novels. So I could never stand up here and just say, well, this is, you know, this, say something really pejorative about it, because I think that all writers publishing history novels now do owe a sort of debt to that phenomenon. And it's also just an interesting phenomenon. I mean, I know that couldn't have happened 10 years ago in publishing, and it's really it's kind of astonishing thing to watch. But I did hear that comparison sometimes, and it did surprise me. Yes.
Have you thought about a new book? Have you have something on the back burner that you would like to write about next?
I actually started writing a new novel in November, and I haven't gotten very far with it because I've been so busy helping to bring this one out. But I'm very excited about it, and it's really rather different from both of the first two, which makes me happy because I have a strong desire to learn something new with every novel. And this is a somewhat embarrassing story, but I'll just tell you how I got the idea for it. And this is almost as cliche as getting the idea for a novel when you're standing on a mountaintop. I think it's worse, actually. I woke up from a dream last spring in the early morning, and in my dream, I'm not making this up, I saw the opening scene of a novel that was about material I'd been thinking about for a long time, and I'd been wondering, how on earth could I use this material? Or maybe I should write a nonfiction book. But I saw the opening scene of a novel, a very dramatic, rather macabre scene, and very surprising. And then I dreamed sort of the trajectory of the book, not scene by scene, but the potential of the middle. And then I dreamed the last scene, which was equally strange and interesting to me. And then in my dream, I saw the paperback of this book. I know this is terrible. I probably shouldn't tell this in public. And I was happy to see that it was tattered and well-worn, well-read. And the title was on the spine. So then I had the title as well. So I guess we have to leave the rest to Carl Jung, but it was really kind of a shocking experience. And I got right up and wrote about 5 pages of notes because it's so easy to forget a dream. And you know, with a lot of dreams, you wake up in the middle of the night and you think, oh, that was brilliant. How could I have dreamed something like that? And you write it down, and then you get up in the morning and look at it. And either it makes no sense, or you wish you hadn't dreamed it anyway. But this one actually made a lot of sense as a story, and so I've been working away at it. Another question? Yes. And then up there.
In both your books, you alternate between different voices, having different people narrating. And can you just talk about what about that appeals to you?
I love people's voices. I love the way people speak and the words they use and the way our own vocabularies and style of speaking kind of make us who we are. And I'm always fascinated by how difficult and interesting it is to try and put that on the page. And I also love first person. I think there's a kind of intimacy about being told a story that's about an I, that is like the way we tell each other stories in life. And I find it very moving. I'm getting a little worried about the fact that I never seem to be able to write anything else. And I've actually started my third novel in third person, close third person. And it's kind of like going to the gym every day. It takes a certain amount of discipline, but once I get there, I really enjoy it. So I'm hoping that I'll learn a lot of new things about writing third person. But I think especially when you hear, when you're writing about history and you give a voice from the past in first person, it is difficult and risky to do. And of course you're making mistakes all over the place probably because we can't know what all voices from the past sounded like. But there is something very intimate about it that I like, that delivers history quite directly. That's a great question. Thank you. And up here?
I was going to ask about what we could look forward to, but since you sort of answered that, my question is then, how long do you think this will take? You went from 10 from 10 years to 4 years. So do you have a deadline for this?
I don't yet. And I've wondered about that. I guess if I keep dropping a few years each time, then maybe I could look forward to writing this one in 2 or 3. But I think every book has its own time, too. And I do a lot of things besides write, and including some teaching and working in Eastern Europe and raising my family. So I have a feeling it's going to be a slow process again. But that's good encouragement. Thank you. This is the most silent auditorium, and nobody is speaking, and I think it's because the seats are all upholstered or something. But does anyone have a last question or two? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Elizabeth. How are you doing?
Hi.
You talked about being interested in the history of art, but the chapter you read to us, it sounded as if you've done painting, or at least you've researched how artists work. So how did you achieve that?
Well, I guess in both ways, really. I did some painting until I was about 16, very poorly, I'm sure. But I started into painting with oils, and before I stopped, I think before I realized how hard that really is. And so I do remember the smell and feel of oils and the wonderful names of colors and how long I had to save my allowance for each tube and all those things. But mostly for this book, I interviewed painters, and I'm lucky to know and be related to several painters, and especially painters in my family were very generous about letting me go on landscape painting trips with them and stand there over their shoulders and ask questions. Why are you putting white on that bush? How did you choose that bush to begin with? Why is the bush to the left and not the right? Why did you put your easel there? And all these, you know, I was able to learn about this, all the a sort of series of decisions that painters make in lots of different ways. And the painters I was interviewing were figurative painters or painters in a kind of realist tradition, or they were in some way not so far from what my painters needed to do. So they weren't practicing abstract painting, for example. And that was incredibly helpful. And I also went to some studio classes, and I had never seen that before. That's really fascinating, where you see the ways in which a painting instructor, the many different ways painting instructors can teach and encourage and set exercises. And that was very helpful because I was writing about studio work and classroom work and other things that I had no experience of. So I really rely very heavily on other people's experience and expertise when I write a novel, and I double check a lot of things for myself. But I've encountered so much generosity from experts, and with this book as well as a historian. Thanks.
I'm going to ask this question because I listened to the the audio version of The Historian rather than reading it on text, and it was wonderful. And I'm wondering if you had any say in who did the reading, and if, you know, that what that was like to figure out, you know, how people were going to hear it and what the voices would be like.
That's such an interesting question. There are actually two audio versions of The Historian. In fact, there are three. There's also a radio reading from the BBC, which is really good. But there are two American versions, and one of them is an abridged version. And it's about half the length of the book. And when I heard they were going to do an abridged version, of course, my innards shriveled. But it's always done for a book that's recorded on tape, that if it's a long book, it's almost always done. And so I asked to be allowed to work on it with them, sort of to do triage. And they did quite a good job with it, and they let me have enormous input. So with The Historian, an abridged version meant no food, no architecture, no diatribes on history, you know. Sort of all the frills removed and the action, the bones of the action left there. So it's not really the same book, and this is a veiled way of saying I hope you read the unabridged version, which it sounds like you did, which is much longer. And it's with the unabridged version, I didn't have any choice in the readers, and I actually didn't hear them until it had been recorded. But I like them very much. I think they did a great job. With The Swan Thieves, I was consulted more about the audio recording. And in fact, I was very touched by this. The sound producer called me up and said, I know there's some music in this book, and we're trying to decide what music to use, either as background to some of the readings or just to signal the ends. You know how the end and the beginning of a CD sometimes or tape have a little musical interlude. And I said, oh, please, please don't have any music in the background, because I think it's very hard to do that without making it sort of disruptive. But I explained the kind of period music that I thought would be good for the endings and beginnings of CDs. And that was really nice to be asked about that. So I have a very random amounts of control over those things, but I've been very pleased with the readers of those books. I've never had that question anywhere before. That's really, and I love books on tape and CD. That's one of the main ways I get to read. So, I know. Yes, over here.
It's a bit of a follow-on from the previous question, but I realize The Historian, which I read, came out about 4 or 5 years ago, I think, and your new book just came out, and these are the two books, I think, that you've produced so far. Have you noticed any dramatic changes in the publishing business during that five-year period? And do you have any thoughts about the Googleization process and...
I've noticed a lot of changes in 5 years, and one of them, well, there are several. One of them is panic and the disruption of the recession, which, of course, made so many publishers either go under or consolidate or merge, and there was tremendous job loss among editors and a lot of discontinuity for writers who had worked with particular editors for years, or editors who had been with particular publishing houses. So there's been a lot of upheaval caused by economic problems. There's also been a real shift in the way books are publicized. I mean, I really knew absolutely nothing about this before I published The Historian, because I was working alone in a room like a lot of writers, and I'd never really known anything about this industry. But the difference in the way this book has been publicized and the way The Historian was publicized in terms of the venues is dramatic to me. Now bloggers have a great deal of power to kind of promote a book. And there are about 10 blogs, literary blogs in the U.S. that sort of make or break the popularity of literary novels in some ways. And it's really, that's something that didn't exist 5 years ago. So 5 years ago, I was asked to do a lot of magazine interviews. I did some this time, but probably half of them were for online magazines or blogs or both. And I guess finally to answer the part of your question that's about Googleization and electronic books, the industry is in a total uproar. I mean, almost every time I talk with any professional with whom I work, in my publishing company, for example, there's sort of a new take on it. And I think publishers are very unsure about what will happen with printed book, whether it will still be a kind of economically feasible to print them. I think readers will not let go of our love of the printed book for a long, long time. I will go to my grave with one. But this is something that's really happening. It's a reality, and it has publishing really in turmoil. I think that there we'll see more and more people who read books for information using those devices, using the Nook or the e-book, or because it's very convenient. It's convenient to get on the train and be able to read 5 manuscripts or 10 books you need for your profession. But I think the pleasure of having and holding a real book is really unchanged for a lot of people. And the question will be more, how can publishers continue to provide that service, that pleasure, and be able to break even ultimately? And that will become more and more of a strain. And what a lot of publishers are doing right now is delaying the e-book, the production of e-books. So The Swan Thieves came out January 12th, and I heard just a couple of days ago that it will come out as an e-book in April. And the publisher has sort of fought for that delay, but couldn't really put it off longer than that. And that's already kind of compromise where the rest of the industry is concerned. So we live in strange times, and I'm not saying this for myself at all, but let's all go on buying books, because there are a lot of people producing very fine books who have done it all their lives, editors, printers, designers, and they need our support more than ever before in this climate. So that's this podium is slightly elevated. That's my soapbox. Yes, in the front.
Thank you. Do you have any say whether you want a book to be published like on the internet or just in print, or is that just is that something they just do with every book now?
I don't really have much say in it. I mean, I presumably I could kick up a huge stink about it, but I'm not sure my agent would even win that battle at this point. Honestly, because it's become so standard, you know, it would be, it's almost to the point where it would be like saying, I'd like you to publish my book, but I refuse to have a paperback. And most publishers would say, well, there's a very nice publisher down the street who might be interested in that. So unfortunately, yeah, that's pretty much the stage publishing has reached. One more question, and then I think we have gotten the nod. Anyone? Or not? Yes, in the front.
I want to ask, there is a very prominent calmness in your personality. Did you achieve it later, or were you born with it?
Would you mind calling home and telling them that? I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about. Thank you very much. I'm honored by that compliment. And I'm not this calm all the time, but I suppose you all have a soothing effect. And I've I don't know. I really don't know. Maybe sitting alone in a room too much has done that to me. I'm not sure. But certainly raising three children has a tendency to make you realize either you're going to have to be very patient or you're really not going to make it through those 20 years. So, but thank you. I appreciate that. Well, on that unusual and lovely note, thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.